This podcast includes content that may be disturbing and hard to listen to. Listener discretion is advised.
Ukraine.
Donbass.
Crimea.
Putin's act of aggression against Ukraine.
Country Ukraine desperately trying to create its own independence, desperately trying to survive.
Full-scale military operation by Russia.
Retaliation by
President of Ukraine.
The Ukrainian president.
Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Zelensky's
master plan that Putin has. Constant barrage of Russian attack.
Ukraine's eastern border.
Violated Ukrainian sovereignty.
To attack Ukraine, as we've seen in the last 4 years.
5 years.
For almost 6 years.
That war's still been going. On. People dying every week, but not really in the headlines.
The humanitarian crisis.
Ukraine, what happened? That's a good question.
In our first Free Ukraine podcast, we give you a snapshot of current events and a hot topic. The embrace by Ukraine's government of the Steinmeier formula, which is part of Zelensky's plan to restart peace talks within the Normandy 4 format with Russia, Germany, and France. As a part of this new approach to breaking the 5-year stalemate, Ukrainian officials announced a tentative plan to start troop rollbacks by 1.5 kilometers on October 7th. This move was delayed because of the never-ending ceasefire violations by Russian-led forces. In order for Ukraine to pull its troops back at any given location, there needs to be at least 7 consecutive days of ceasefire. But there hasn't been a single day that Russia has not broken the agreed-upon truces. So we don't know when the tactical withdrawals of Ukrainian troops will occur, or what the next steps the Ukrainian government plans to take just yet. Which brings us to the topic of this episode. What has happened on the front lines of Donbas, then and now? This podcast is meant for English listeners to understand the events that have occurred in Ukraine in order to stay informed and in the know. When discussing the theme of soldiers on the front line in Ukraine, you should know the names of 3 key battles from 2014-15, Ilovaisk, Donetsk Airport, and the Baltseva. You have to know who Ukrainian cyborgs are and what they represent symbolically. No, Ukraine does not have cybernetic robot soldiers fighting the Russian aggression in Donbas. If that's what you're looking for, the latest installment of the Terminator movie series is hitting theaters around the world now. Ukraine's cyborgs were flesh and blood, often volunteers who dropped their normal civilian lives in late 2014, and everyone knows who you're talking about. When Russian aggression first started in eastern Ukraine in the spring of 2014, the 2 main cities to take the worst of it, cities still under occupation, were Donetsk and Luhansk. The Donetsk airport became a symbol of Ukraine's fight against Russian-led forces. The fight for the airport, rebuilt for the 2012 European Soccer Championships, lasted for 242 grueling days, with Ukrainian soldiers outgunned, outmanned, and facing odds not in their favor.
Russia is strong. We knew that she was strong. We perfectly understand, of course, she is stronger than us. Why lie to yourself? They have the army, the technology, but I have a question, comparison. I have a wife, and I'm not super tall. But if we were to walk around the neighborhood and 2 men tried to take her and do stuff to her, of course I would fight and get hit in the face. Without a doubt, they are stronger. But I won't tell her, listen, honey, just capitulate. They won't do anything too bad, and afterwards, we'll scold them. No. You, like a normal person, will fight to the end to protect your own.
That was Yevgeny Kovtun, a cyborg who was evacuated, wounded, in the last vehicle to leave the Donetsk airport in January of 2015, the day the airport fell. I sat down with him recently in a Kiev cafe around the corner from a chess competition his 7-year-old son was competing in, as he recalled his experience in the airport terminal day by day. Zhenya had never served in the military before. He graduated with a degree in computer science and worked in IT and in television. But when Ukrainian forces started to retake territory in 2014 and suffer from the heavy battles, Zhenya volunteered. The army didn't take him immediately because he had no specialities or military training, so they put him on the reserve list. 2 months later, he was called up, along with his friend Denise, who also served as a TV producer.
With my group, no one had ever served in the army before. Those who had specialties were sent somewhere else. Then we found out that we were going to serve in the 1st Battalion, which was the one that was defeated in Ilovaisi. There are parts still coming out from the fight, about 100 lost. From that moment, my war started for our state. Started in Peske, a town on the edge of Donetsk. I was injured, had a bent arm. I went to the hospital. My friend stayed to serve. They needed soldiers in Donetsk airport, and my friend got the airport. They decided not to ask me because my arm was not fully healed, even though I was still fighting. But my arm practically didn't work. I needed help buttoning and unbuttoning my jacket. I decided to go with them because we studied together and it usually would be an order for two people. But that time it wasn't. So they sent us to the airport. And it just so happened that we ended up at the airport control tower. And I at the new terminal. I got there on the 6th of January.
Before arriving at the Donetsk airport, the Ukrainian soldiers had to go through what they call green corridors that a high-ranking officer decided to implement in order to lessen the amount of soldiers lost while traveling to the airport. It was to keep this myth and legend of having defenders of the Donetsk airport, to lose a minimum of lives while entering the airport because it was completely surrounded by the enemy, and the Ukrainian soldiers would have to drive through enemy checkpoints to actually get there.
And there was this bridge, and we would arrive. We were all greeted by Russian fighters. They would unload us from the cars, search us, check us, and count us. They allowed us to bring my standard weapon, one ammo case that was unfastened to a rifle. We weren't allowed to bring ammunition with us, only water. It wasn't clear to me, am I going into a hard battle? To fight and die, and before I do, they are checking us at the bridge? Before me, others were driven in the same way, were given out the same way. So they drive them to the fight, spill blood, and then drive out when the enemy allows them. There was a deal, probably. The numbers of those who came in significantly fell. We knew that we were going to war, and they could kill us in this war. And we knowingly were going there. And then there's some high cabinet official who supposedly is looking after us, actually doing us a disservice to make a deal so that we could enter through the enemy that were killing us.
These so-called green corridors in the Donetsk airport are similar to what Russian President Vladimir Putin also calls humanitarian corridors, as he did in August of 2014 when Russian commanders promised free passage for over 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers encircled in the town of Ilovaisk.
The initial phase of the crisis back in April, May, June of 2014, pro-Russian separatists were in control of the larger part of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. They were in control of Slavyansk, actually on the border between Donetsk and Kharkiv oblasts. They were in control of Severodonetsk, Kramatorsk, Mariupol, approaching 500,000 population strong. With the start of anti-terrorist operation, Ukrainian military, police, and volunteer formations pushed these illegal armed formation, as we call it, on the Ukrainian legislation. And by August 2014, were in control of about 90% of this region, these two oblasts. They liberated Slavyansk, they liberated Kramatorsk, Debaltseve, Mariupol. They were on the outskirts of Donetsk. However, this is where Russian troops en masse crossed the border.
That was Leonid Polyakov from the Center for Army Conversion and Disarmament Studies. Leonid served as the first Deputy Minister of Defense for Ukraine from 2005 to 2008 and again briefly in the spring of 2014. As Ukraine's general staff prepared for a military parade in Kyiv on Ukrainian Independence Day in August 2014, Putin sent Russian armored units deep into Ukrainian territory, turn circle, and destroy advancing Ukrainian forces centered in Ilovaisk en masse. Putin's Russian commanders promised to allow free passage through a so-called corridor, but it turned out to be a trap. Russian-led forces opened fire instead. The official Ukrainian death toll from Ilovaisk is 366, but some unofficial estimates are over 1,000 soldiers, since there were many volunteers from volunteer battalions who did not have identifying dog tags. You can't count the amount of times Russia has broken its word when it comes to the war in Ukraine. Since both Minsk agreements in September of 2014 and February of 2015, there hasn't been a single day where Russian-led forces observed a complete ceasefire in Ukrainian territory. This past Monday, October 21st, 17 enemy attacks were reported in Donbas, 12 enemy attacks on Sunday, October 20th, 8 attacks and 1 wounded soldier on Saturday the 19th. You get the picture. Back to January 2015 and the drama at the Donetsk airport. Zhenya arrived at the Donetsk airport on January 6th amidst bitter cold. The temperature plunged to as low as negative 28 degrees Celsius. His friend was assigned to the airport control tower as a spotter, and Zhenya took up position in the remnants of the new terminal built for the 2012 European Soccer Championship. By that point, Russia-led forces already controlled the old terminal.
The old terminal at this point in time was already lost. The terminal was a creepy place. I think that if there was a hell on earth, it would be there. There were no windows, some cement walls. The whole place was burnt. Harsh frost, no water, because it would freeze, and we had no way of heating it up because we were surrounded by snipers. Any construction of the airport terminals are similar. It's enormous. It consists of many floors. There were 5 floors above us and 2 under us. We sat on the second floor. We controlled the one floor, which was probably 20 to 30% of the terminal. All the other floors were taken over by the enemy and the basement. So we were essentially in a sandwich with the enemy under us, above us, behind us, or both sides, and just surrounding us completely.
Аэропорт. Место боевых действий. Ой. Затихло, Ленечка. Ой, затихло. Пора и повоевать.
Женя shows me a video in which he walks around the terminal with his phone, filming the walls, debris, and the outside between the small openings in their barricade. There is very little light.
We didn't even have the ability to tell night from day because there wasn't enough light. Sometimes moonlight would break through the bullet holes on the floors we were on, through 5 floors of bullet holes.
When Zhenya arrived at the new terminal and took up his position, he felt alone. There was no constant contact with team members because the number of remaining cyborgs were low and they were stretched very thin across a large space.
We were covered by the airport control tower. It was a lot higher, and my friend was sitting there as a commanding officer. For days, I wouldn't be able to see him well, but he could see me well. Often, I could sleep better knowing that I had my friend watching over. There were only 55 of us in the terminal, and we were battered with hunger. Well, the hunger wasn't really there because we were constantly fighting, but the cold was battering for sure. Cold that would get below 27, 28 degrees Celsius.
Дай їм поспать нормально.
Слава Україні!
Героям слава.
The fighting dragged on for days. They would not stop. We started to lose people. From my subdivision, only 5 of us were left. Half of us had not died, thank God, from my subdivision. But an RPG flew in and really injured them. They were alive, but injured.
Кстати, вот, в нас попало РПГ. Один контуженный, одного откинуло. Покажи РПГ.
Та что ты РПГ не видел, ёлки-палки?
Вот такое. Это я скину видео деткам покажу.
Женни shows me another video, turning the camera over to show what damage the RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade, had done. You can hear his comrades in the back urging him to show off an RPG. The camera turns to one of his men holding an RPG. Here he says, as if people haven't seen one. His friend tells him, I want to send the video and show it to my kids.
The scariest moment for me then was that the higher-ups didn't want to help, because someone had to take responsibility to support us. A very big explosion occurred. I think that I needed to say what happened, how it actually was, so there isn't any additional generalization, no additional people who are telling stories. One of the enemies attacked the column that was where we were shooting from. And it caused very serious mutilations to one of the men. It tore his leg, larynx, and jaw. Very serious mutilations. He was young. His name was Igor Rimorik. We brought him to our great doctor, also a young guy. His name was Igor Zinik. He tried to stabilize him so that the young man wouldn't die. We all understood that you are fighting to that moment until they kill you or injure you. And you know at that moment the war is ending for you, and that no matter what, you needed to evacuate, because you essentially completed your duty to the end. In terms of the evacuation, yes, 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 get the guy out of there. But the guy is lying there. And to understand the time frame, it probably took days. On the second day, his specific evacuation did not happen because the Green Corridor would only open in 5 days' time. And if they were to try and send a car, it would end the treaty and someone would have to answer for that order. And no one wanted to answer for it. We were responsible for our lives and duty, but not the image of the president. Eventually, I understood that all of this war, that was the scariest decision. I and no one else could exert influence. The conditions were clear. There would be no evacuation. No one would come for us, and no one would come for this young man.
Nearly 5 years later, the cumulative death toll of this war has risen to 13,000. Last week, on October 15th, Russia violated the ceasefire 26 times, wounding 4 soldiers and killing 2. Of the 2 soldiers killed by snipers, one was Yaroslava Nikonenko. Her father, Sergei Nikonenko, who also fought in Donbas, was a highly respected officer and died in battle in 2015. Thousands of people came to his funeral in Mirgorod, central Ukraine, and both his daughters volunteered to serve in the army. Yaroslava Ninkina was 36 and served on the front line as part of the 101st Brigade. Each month, on her Facebook page, Yaroslava published lists of Ukrainian soldiers killed in battles that month. She took part in the commemoration of the heroes who fell at Ilovaisk in August of 2014. She published stories of living and dead heroes, stories about combat operations. She leaves behind her 13-year-old daughter.
The snow was piling high, and there were extreme frosts. So we were supposed to, at night, have 2 soldiers from his subdivision take him on a stretcher and carry him to the enemy line, where the enemy would have to take him and promise us that they would carry him to our block post and give him to our medic. I don't think this has ever happened in other wars, this stupidity. It seems like it comes from the world of fantasy. But this was fact. Eventually, they did just that. There is a story where they described it.
The fighting for Donetsk airport intensified in mid-January of 2015. A Russian group tried to break through. Zhenya's team caught and destroyed them. After this incident, the enemies grew smarter. They started to target the control tower.
They understood that if the airport control tower would fall, we would be left on our own, because our eyes would go dark. And it would be easy to destroy us. 2 days passed where they shot the control tower without break at whatever was left of it. On the 13th of January, the tower collapsed. The enemy thought everyone in there was dead. The tower collapsed, and my friend told me that God must have covered them with his hand, because around them was one hole that was big enough to save them. There were no casualties, not even an injury, when the tower collapsed. The enemy returned thinking there was no one left in the tower. The separatists started an intense attack. Then they suffered heavy losses and fell back.
The fighting was still constant until the 16th of January. At that point, Ukrainian commanders decided to make a large push to relieve the cyborgs isolated in the airport terminal, the men from the 90th Battalion. Zhenya and the others had no idea this was happening, because they had lost all contact at this point.
The guys from the 90th Battalion knew where they were going, what they needed to do, and that they were driving to their deaths. They reached us and lifted our spirits. The fact that we weren't abandoned in the end, that we could still fight. We felt we could still hold the front somehow. And luckily, the battle started turning in our favor. We understood that we will live longer.
Ukraine receives multiple kinds of support, financial, material, I would say advisory support. If we start from the military, countries like United States, Canada, and many others provide their instructors. Almost all NATO countries and some other, as far as Japan and Australia, provide material support for the military and for Ukrainian police and border guards as well. They also offer medical support for wounded and handicapped. In terms of internally displaced persons, there are projects as well, and not only from the governments but from international organizations of different kind, humanitarian like Red Cross and human rights. Also countries like Germany, for instance, provide regular financial support almost every year, I would say, for different reasons related to establishing peace and order on liberated territories of Donbas, on humanitarian demining. I can recall Switzerland, for instance. There are many examples, and it would probably take a long time not only to list, but just to recall from my memory. As of recently, you can find on the website of DCAF, the study to which my organization contributed. It's called Mapping of Ukraine's Security Sector Support from Foreign Partners. And in euros, it amounts for 3 years, I believe, over 3 billion euros.
On the 14th, there was supposed to be a shift swap in my unit. Because I came later, I was not able to swap yet. We had a rule to be there for 2 weeks with no break, and then we could change shifts. Of the five friends that arrived with me, there were four left. One got injured. For them, the terminal swap happened on the 14th. I went over to say goodbye, saying, "All right, it's all right, guys, go ahead and leave. We will soon have replacements. You served honorably. Instead of you guys, someone will come." And I knew that no one was coming, because we had no more strength left. I knew the car would come for the injured, and I knew they would also take the men. Those were the rules. I was surprised when I returned from the post to see all of them there. drinking tea, saying, "You know, we decided we will either all leave together or not at all." I said to them, "You understand, it's most likely that no one is going to get out of here." On January 16th, we were glad to see a strong offensive from our side. There were tanks, our flags. The 6th Company consisted of practically guys coming from Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. These were men who were coming home with flags into Donetsk. They were going home. Of course, their motivation was colossal. Then everything got quiet, for a day almost. People partially withdrew from the control tower. There were 6 people left in the control tower to show that there was someone there. And we were left on our own. And then the enemy started to smoke us out. Their tanks rolled out, started attacks. This went on for days. It took out all of our strength. Besides the extreme frost, we were nibbling on scraps of food and frozen water. The injured would thaw the ice to turn it into water. I lost friends from my subdivision. Out of our division, there were 3 of us left. There were about 40 other men from other subdivisions. Overnight, out of 50 of us, 13 got injured, and 5 or 4 dead. In the morning, men from the 94th Battalion came, fresh and strong, and everything started all over again.
At this point, Zhenya and his men were not holding onto 200 to 300 meters of the floor of the terminal. On the 16th, 17th of January, the space they had held narrowed to the size of the cafe he and I sat during this interview, a singular room, a corner of the terminal.
We stood at this corner and tried to fend them off. We weren't even occupying 1% of this terminal. We had a lot of injured, a lot of fallen, but we stood. I don't know how we dealt without food. I guess that's why we earned the name cyborgs. They were very difficult battles. We formed a conveyor belt. Part of a group was standing in the corner, and the injured that were lying on the ground were somehow trying to clean and check the guns to make sure they were working properly. And this conveyor belt would run days at a time, against the wall, standing, standing, standing. We were like an injured animal who has nowhere to retreat, but we understood we wouldn't surrender.
The cyborg soldiers of Donetsk and their story is so revered that there is now a comic book series about the 242 days they defended the airport. The NGO True to Tradition was founded by active military, volunteers, and activists in 2016 to counteract the Russian aggression in terms of information. They also provide medical, legal, and social assistance to veterans and active soldiers. These comics depict the real memories of the defenders of the Donetsk airport, with each warrior telling his story and taking part in the creation of the publication. They chose the comic book format to provide a format of easy and understandable storytelling to children and adolescents. They write, "In our childhood, we always look for superheroes who we want to be like. As we grow older, we get frustrated because Superman turns out to be flying only down, and instead of a Batmobile, Polish tins. Our cyborgs are living, real, not invented in Marvel Studios, but are forged in the throes of fighting for our home, Ukraine." So Zhenya and his men were down to a small corner of the room with heavy fire coming at them from all sides. And then something unimaginable happened. The firing stopped. After a heavy battle that lasted all day, there was a temporary treaty that took place between the separatists and the Ukrainian army. But it wasn't to get the cyborgs out of there. The Russian-backed militants requested a temporary treaty in order to gather their injured, as the extreme freezes would freeze them to death. Zhenya and the rest of the cyborgs weren't given the option to drive out their injured. His injured weren't even preparing to be rescued, while the enemy was allowed.
At this point, we didn't have communication with the commanding officers of the Ministry of Defense. They kind of supported us verbally, but I understand that our ex-president, Poroshenko, held on to the symbol of Donetsk Airport. His advisor replied to one of my friends who wrote to him. He wrote saying, "My brother is there. You understand that you need to get them out of here." And they probably thought, "You really want us to give the order to allow the last of you to leave the airport with the whole country, all of diaspora, and everyone in the world glued to their TV screens watching these heroic battles going on?" The advisor only wrote back, "I'm sorry that your brother is there. That wasn't his luck."
It was the 19th of January. The cyborgs were still holding on. The enemy mined a large hole and filled it with explosive charges. The explosion completely wiped out the rest of the standing walls and debris. Somehow, not a single cyborg died. A wall had fallen onto Zhenya, and the men dug him out.
The enemy thought that not a single one of us survived, and started to return to their posts. And we were filled with such rage, and thought, how could this be? And we used bricks and pieces of the wall and concrete to create a barricade. We created a half circle up to our knees of trash, debris, and bricks. And for us, a field of vision was opened, and space to fire back as the enemy was retreating. Repelled this attack, the enemy lost a lot of men. After the explosion, many of us were injured and shell-shocked. The doctor, Igor Zinik, suffered very serious injuries, and he said, "If I don't end up in the hospital very soon, I will die." Somehow, we had our spirits lifted by the fact that we had survived and fought back.
The next day, on the 20th of January, the enemy tried a different tactic. This time, they went to the floor below and placed the explosives on the supporting columns underneath the cyborgs. They fell through, as did all five floors above them, crushing them. Ukrainian sappers neutralized almost 700 explosives in Donbas over the past week of October 17th. In the 63 hectares of territory in Donbas, they neutralized 689 explosives. According to the State Emergency Service, emergency repairs of residential buildings have occurred, and so far, 11 houses have been repaired this week. A total of 933 people were provided with psychological and medical assistance.
Everyone suffered monstrous injuries. We had our arms and legs torn off. Many suffered greatly. I thank God that I survived the explosion. I had already been walking around with a bullet lodged in my ribs for the previous 4 days. I already had a terrible fever. On the 15th day, I was fighting in the frost. I would just be walking and falling. I'd be consistently fainting. We started to retrieve our fallen and injured. The rest of my friends all died. We found a few under the rubble. They stayed because of me, and there were no more.
The men categorized themselves into two categories. Those who were severely injured, and those who weren't as much. They knew that by morning, it would be bad for them if help wouldn't arrive in time. They had no more strength left. Zhenya was put in the heavily injured category. There were several guys that were in good enough shape to continue some sort of fighting. The enemy was very surprised once again. Edward Basurin, one of the leaders of the Russian-backed forces that had occupied parts of the Donetsk Oblast, claimed that the famed Ukrainian cyborg soldiers were being given psychotropic drugs to enhance their fighting performance. They didn't understand the integrity and sheer will these soldiers had. Every time they had thought that they had finally extinguished them, they were proven wrong.
Someone woke me up that night and said, "We will succeed." And I said, "Who and how? We don't even know where our people were because After the attack, we lost track of our position. Then it felt like God came to help us once more. The horrendous freeze ended, and the ice water started to drip on our hands. We were completely soaked, and then the thick, terrifying fog settled. The fog was like milk. You couldn't see anything. I didn't know if I could even get up or not. Not only did I have little strength left, but after the explosion, everything hurt so much, I didn't know what was broken or not. My arm couldn't move, my leg was bent the wrong way. Next to me lay a comrade from another subdivision. He was also lying injured. His legs were both shot, one with a bullet, the other broken maybe. And I said to him, "So what? Are we going to leave?" And he said, "I can't get up." And I said, "And I can't get up." To get out of the field, all we needed to crawl through a small window-like opening. For us, this was equivalent of competing in the Olympics, but we agreed that I would push him and he would fall out like a sack, and then he would pull me through. And the group of us understood we couldn't bring the most injured out with us because they were entirely broken. We didn't even know where we were leaving to. This was our last hope, the last battle. 13 of us got out. 3 of us stayed behind to protect the heavily injured. Well, it's a long story how we walked through. The distance isn't too big, but if you count, the enemy was throughout this territory. Fields that go for miles. We don't know where our people are. An insane fog where you can't see anything. Then our sheer will must have led us.
They somehow got out, and the first checkpoint they reached happened to be Ukrainian. The first thing they did was ask for water and telephones to report the situation. They had no contact for the past 4 days. They reported that the flag still stood and that there were still men there. Several hours after they had left, it was clear that the group of injured left behind was freezing and dying one by one. In the morning, help came through. 3 MTLBs, armored tracked vehicles for evacuating people, arrived. They were completely smoked out. They came to help, and all of them died except for a few. And as for the injured, all of them had been taken as prisoners. This week, on October 18th, 2019, it was reported that a total of 257 persons are considered missing in the areas occupied by pro-Russian forces in Donbas, and 240 have been illegally deprived of liberty. The Security Service of Ukraine said this in an updated report to Radio Liberty. Union, the Ukrainian Independent Information Agency, reported on August 30th of this year that the Red Cross Society of Ukraine had registered cases of 700 missing persons throughout the period of Donbas hostilities.
And that's how the most tragic and heroic chapter of the war ended. It's counted to have ended the 21st of January 2015. There were few men left in the control tower, some in the fire station, but they considered the 21st the day we lost the airport, after 242 days. After I went to the hospital, as much as I was immobilized, I didn't want to make a fuss. I understood that there were those that had been taken prisoner, so I returned.
The 3 men who stayed behind to guard the injured were captured and beaten very badly. One of them was so beaten up that when the leader of the separatists, codename Motorola, a pro-Russian maniac who used a former psychiatric hospital in Kramatorsk as a torture center in 2014, showed up, shot him to put him out of his misery. His name was Igor Branovitsky, and he spent his last moments protecting the injured. He was awarded the Hero of Ukraine Medal, the highest national title that can be conferred upon an individual citizen by the president, for his exceptional personal courage, heroism, and self-sacrifice, expressed in the defense of state sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, and loyalty to military oath. The medic, Igor Zinich, also died. He was in the terminal and didn't evacuate when offered. He was also given the Hero of Ukraine Medal for his exceptional courage, heroism, and unbreakable spirit revealed in defense of state sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, a sacrificial service to the Ukrainian people. I asked Leonid Polyakov, the ex-deputy minister of defense, now chairman at the Center for Army Conversion and Disarmament Studies, what the possible outcomes for Ukraine are.
We Ukrainians have to be patient, we have to be wise, we have to be resilient. And then there is a chance for a good outcome. When I say Ukraine has to be resilient, I mean several things. First of all, avoid any serious concessions, which cannot bring a progress, but definitely are already bringing internal discontent among part of citizens who can be called patriots and part of citizens who are kind of neutral, infantile, you understand, just clear communication, more investment in defense, successful improving of business climate in terms of courts, prevention of corruption, improving social climate. In all these political, economic, social areas, there are certain rooms for improvement. And if the government is successful, just for people to feel improvements on one side, and if the government is successful on improving the defense, what we'll have status quo. I think this patient, resilient approach is the best way, course for Ukraine right now.
We don't know what's going to happen next. Every week, anything could happen, and there could be a new player involved. The one consistent event is the ceasefire violations and attacks by Russian aggressors. Ukraine must find a way to move forward, or to stay resilient as more soldiers die on the Eastern Front. Zhenya has returned back to his life and family, although he admits that none of the cyborgs have really returned to normalcy as it was before the war. Having gone through what they did, the war hasn't ended for them. He currently has his own business. He finds comfort in his home, family, and things that bring him joy. Things that make him live, he says. He told me, "I am telling this story about the Donetsk airport to show how we could stand and fight for a piece of land that was 50 to 60 meters, to sink our teeth into the concrete, and to stand by every centimeter of our land. We need to prepare, we need to raise our children in a way that they understood this country, this flag, and this territory." As for Zhenya's son, who was competing at the chess competition down the street, he won 2 games and lost 1. He'll win all 3 next time. That's it for episode 2 of Free Ukraine. Next week, we sit down and talk about what comes next, mental health programs and mental health in general in Ukraine. I cannot thank Yevgeny Kovtun enough for sitting down for this interview, sending me videos and photos of his battles in the terminal, and for his service. Thank you to Leonid Polyakov. Thank you to the NGO True to Tradition for all their work and their service. You can check out their website and comic book store at kiborhikomics.com.ua. And of course, you. Thank you for listening.